Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Good morning, everybody. Happy May to everybody. Happy final day of contemporary issues for this spring, so I'm very glad you joined us.
On the last day.
On the last day. We didn't cancel just because you're here.
Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
Hanging in there, I think.
So, I've got a couple of business items, well, one business item, and then sort of some follow-up from last week, and then set up for this week. The business item is we're going to meet again in the fall, and I don't know what we're talking about. So what I have here are little sheets of paper and little pens that if there is a topic that you are interested in, you can be super specific about it, you can be super broad about it, you can just write down a question. Feel free to write down something you're interested in us studying in the fall, and I'll see what I can find and learn and put a conversation together about it. So we have been talking about global climate change for these current 4 weeks, so the past 3 weeks and today. We started with talking about, okay, why does that matter? From sort of let's ground this in what's important to us as a congregation. Then we talked about what do we know and how do we know it. Then we last week we talked about, okay, it's happening. Global climate change is happening, so what do we do? How do we adapt? So last week was kind of more small scale focused in terms of There is a problem. What do we do in a world where this is the problem, where the climate is changing, where extreme weather is becoming more common, and how do we and how can communities adapt? Today we're going to talk about what if we could actually change the world sufficiently to actually reverse climate change. What would that look like? So we're gonna turn to that in just a moment, but I want to just touch on last week we mentioned the idea that soil itself is actually a really great carbon sink. It does a great job of sequestering carbon if the soil is biologically active, right? So your sterile potting soil, so your houseplants don't get all moldy, is not helpful, right? But your living, wormy, buggy, moldy after, you know, I've got all kinds of mushrooms coming up in my yard now, after rain like this, that soil is actually really great for sucking carbon back out of the atmosphere. So are the plants that grow in the soil. But to have healthy soil, you need a healthy, well, ecosystem in your yard. And so I come with a book recommendation. This is what happens when I go home and talk about what we talked about. This is Bringing Nature Home by Doug Tallamy. He was in Des Moines just a few weeks ago giving a talk. But he has also written here, Bringing Nature Home. This is about sort of landscaping with native plants and understanding how different plants work together in order to facilitate animal life, which supports plant life, which supports the microbial life, which supports the plant life. You know how that works. And is all a contributor to healthy ecosystems can actually help to counterbalance some of the carbon damage that we're doing. So there's a recommendation for further reading for you. Today, the question is, can we turn this ship around, Can we actually reverse global climate change? So the primary driver of global climate change is global warming. So on average, the planet is warming. The oceans, for instance, are warming much more slowly on average than the land is, because the oceans have a much higher thermal mass. But the climate is changing as more energy is in the atmosphere. More energy is in the atmosphere because carbon dioxide and other carbon compounds, but carbon dioxide is sort of the easy one to count and do the math with. And it's the predominant gas in the atmosphere that is absorbing infrared radiation. So it's like putting a blanket on the bed. And so for a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere, the temperature will rise, the global temperature will rise to a certain amount. So in order to reverse climate change, what do we need to do? Get carbon out of the atmosphere. To summarize 2 weeks ago, we know this is happening, we know this is human driven because of the times at which it happened and the time when the global concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere have spiked relative to human use of fossil fuels. So there's the science in 4 seconds. So this is happening. What can we do? We've been watching TED Talks, which are great. Here's one more. And I'm going to recommend another one for you that you have to watch after class. Not immediately after class, go to worship. But then after class, there's another one about how do we talk about climate change in a civil conversation when we're not all on the same page about climate change as a thing that's happening. So you have to watch that one too before you go talk to anybody about what we've done here. But 100 solutions to reverse global warming. You'll be very excited about 4 of them. They're all great. 100 solutions to reverse global warming. And this is from September of 2018. So this is a very recent TED Talk. So taking basically all of the current global political realities into account, 100 solutions to reverse global warming.
To a word you may never have heard before, but you ought to know. Draw down. Draw down is a new way of thinking about and acting on global warming. It's a goal for a future that we want, a future where reversing global warming is possible. Draw down is that point in time when atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases begin to decline on a year-to-year basis. More simply, it's that point when we take out more greenhouse gases than we put in to Earth's atmosphere. Now, I know we're all concerned about climate change, but climate change is not the problem. Climate change is the expression of the problem. It's the feedback of the system, of the planet, telling us what's going on. The problem is global warming, provoked by the increasing concentrations of greenhouse gases caused by human activity. So how do we solve the problem? How do we begin the process of reversing global warming? The only way we know how is to draw down, to avoid putting greenhouse gases up, and to pull down what's already there. I know, given the current situation, it sounds impossible. But humanity already knows what to do. We have real, workable technologies and practices that can achieve drawdown. And it's already happening. What we need is to accelerate implementation, and to change the discourse from one of fear and confusion, which only leads to apathy, to one of understanding and possibility, and therefore opportunity. I work for an organization called Project Drawdown. For the last 4 years, together with a team of researchers and writers from all over the world, we've mapped, measured, and detailed 100 solutions to reversing global warming. 80 already exist today, and when taken together, those 80 can achieve drawdown. And 20 are coming attractions, solutions on the pipeline, and when they come online, will speed up our progress. These are solutions that are viable, scalable, and financially feasible. And they do one or more of three things. Replace existing fossil fuel-based energy generation with clean, renewable sources. Reduce consumption through technological efficiency and behavior change. And to biosequester carbon and our plants' biomass and soils through a process we all learned in grade school, the magic of photosynthesis. It's through a combination of these three mechanisms that drawdown becomes possible. So how do we get there? Well, here's the short answer. This is a list of the top 20 solutions to reversing global warming. Now I'll go into some detail, but take a few seconds to look over the list. It's eclectic, I know. From onshore wind turbines to educating girls, from plant-rich diets to rooftop solar technology. So let's break it down a little bit. To the right of the slide, you'll see figures in gigatons or billions of tons. That represents the total equivalent carbon dioxide reduced from the atmosphere when the solution is implemented globally over a 30-year period. Now, when we think about climate solutions, we often think about electricity generation. We think of renewable energy as the most important set of solutions, and they are incredibly important. But the first thing to notice about this list is that only 5 of the top 20 solutions relate to electricity. What surprised us, honestly, was that 8 of the top 20 relate to the food system. The climate impact of food may come as a surprise to many people. But what these results show is that the decisions we make every day about the food we produce, purchase, and consume are perhaps the most important contributions every individual can make to reversing global warming. And how we manage land is also very important. Protecting forests and wetlands safeguards, expands, and creates new carbon sinks that directly draw down carbon. This is how drawdown can happen. And when we take food and land management together, 12 of the top 20 solutions relate to how and why we use land. This fundamentally shifts traditional thinking on climate solutions. But let's go to the top of the list, because I think what's there may also surprise you. The single most impactful solution, according to this analysis, would be refrigeration management, or properly managing and disposing of hydrofluorocarbons, also known as HFCs, which are used by refrigerators and air conditioners to cool the air. We did a great job with the Montreal Protocol to limit the production of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, because of their effect on the ozone layer. But they were replaced by HFCs, which are hundreds to thousands of times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And that 90 gigatons reduced is a conservative figure. If we were to account for the impact of the Kigali Agreement of 2016, which calls for the phase out of hydrofluorocarbons and replace them with natural refrigerants, which exist today, this number could increase to 120 to nearly 200 gigatons of avoided greenhouse gases. Maybe you're surprised as we were. Now, before going into some details of specific solutions, you may be wondering how we came to these calculations. Well, first of all, we collected a lot of data, and we used statistical analysis to create ranges that allow us to choose reasonable choices for every input used throughout the models. And we chose a conservative approach, which underlies the entire project. All that data is entered into the model, ambitiously but plausibly projected into the future, and compared against what we would have to do anyway. The 84 gigatons reduced from onshore wind turbines, for example, results from the electricity generated from wind farms that would otherwise be produced from coal or gas-fired plants. We calculate all the costs to build and to operate the plants and all the emissions generated. The same process is used to compare recycling versus landfilling, regenerative versus industrial agriculture, protecting versus cutting down our forests. The results are then integrated within and across systems to avoid double counting and added up to see if we actually get to drawdown. Okay, let's go into some specific solutions. Rooftop solar comes in ranked number 10. When we picture rooftop solar in our minds, we often envision a warehouse in Miami covered in solar panels. But these are solutions that are relevant in urban and rural settings, high and low income countries, and they have cascading benefits. This is a family on a straw island in Lake Titicaca receiving their first solar panel. Before, kerosene was used for cooking and lighting, kerosene on a straw island. So by installing solar, this family is not only helping to reduce emissions, but providing safety and security for their household. And tropical forests tell their own story. Protecting currently degraded land in the tropics and allowing natural regeneration to occur is the number five solution to reversing global warming. We can think of trees as giant sticks of carbon. This is drawdown in action every year as carbon is removed from the atmosphere through photosynthesis, which converts carbon dioxide to plants' biomass and soil organic carbon. And we need to rethink how we produce our food to make it more regenerative. There are many ways to do this, and we've researched over 13 of them, but these aren't new ways of producing food. They have been practiced for centuries, for generations. But they are increasingly displaced by modern agriculture, which promotes tillage, monocropping, and the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, which degrade the land and turn into a net emitter of greenhouse gases. Regenerative agriculture, on the other hand, restores soil health and productivity, increases yield, improves water retention, benefits smallholder farmers and large farming operations alike, and brings carbon back to the land. It's a win-win-win-win-win. It's not just how we produce food, but what we consume that has a massive impact on global warming. A plant-rich diet is not a vegan or a vegetarian diet, though I applaud any who make those choices. It's a healthy diet in terms of how much we consume, and particularly how much meat is consumed. In the richer parts of the world, we overconsume. However, low-income countries show an insufficient caloric and protein intake. That needs rebalancing. And it's in the rebalancing that a plant-rich diet becomes the number four solution to reversing global warming. Moreover, approximately a third of all food produced is not eaten. And wasted food emits an astounding 8% of global greenhouse gases. We need to look where across the supply chain these losses and wastage occurs. In low-income countries, after food leaves the farm, most food is wasted early in the supply chain due to infrastructure and storage challenges. Food's not wasted by consumers in low-income countries which struggle to feed their population. In the developed world, instead, after food leaves the farm, most food is wasted at the end of the supply chain by markets and consumers. And wasted food ends up in a landfill where it emits methane and as it decomposes. This is a consumer choice problem. It's not a technology issue. Preventing food waste from the beginning is the number three solution. But here's the interesting thing. When we look at the food system as a whole, and we implement all the production solutions like regenerative agriculture, and we adopt a plant-rich diet, and we reduce food waste. Our research shows that we would produce enough food on current farmland to feed the world's growing population a healthy, nutrient-rich diet, now until 2050 and beyond. That means we don't need to cut down forests for food production. The solutions to reversing global warming are the same solutions to food insecurity. Now, a solution that often does not get talked enough about, family planning. By providing men and women the right to choose when, how, and if to raise a family, through reproductive health clinics and education, access to contraception, and freedom devoid of persecution, can reduce the estimated global population by 2050. That reduced population means reduced demand for electricity, food, travel, buildings, and all other resources. All the energy and emissions that are used to produce that higher demand is reduced by providing the basic human right to choose when, how, and if to raise a family. But family planning cannot happen without equal quality of education to girls currently being denied access. Now, we've taken a small liberty here because the impact of universal education and family planning resources are so inextricably intertwined that we chose to cut it right down the middle. But taken together, educating girls and family planning is the number one solution to reversing global warming, reducing approximately 120 billion tons of greenhouse gases. So is drawdown possible? The answer is yes. It is possible, but we need all 80 solutions. There are no silver bullets or subset of solutions that are going to get us there. The top solutions will take us far along the pathway, but there's no such thing as a small solution. We need all 80. But here's the great thing. We would want to implement these solutions whether or not global warming was even a problem, because they have cascading benefits to human and planetary well-being. Renewable electricity results in clean, abundant access to energy for all. Plant-rich diet, reduced food waste, results in a healthy global population with enough food and sustenance. Family planning and educating girls, this is about human rights, about gender equality. This is about economic improvement and the freedom of choice. It's about justice. Regenerative agriculture, managed grazing, agroforestry, silvopasture, restores soil health, benefits farmers, and brings carbon back to the land. Protecting our ecosystems also protects biodiversity and safeguards planetary health. And the oxygen that we breathe, its tangible benefits to all species is incalculable. But one last point, because I know it's probably on everybody's mind, how much is this going to cost? Well, we estimate that to implement all 80 solutions would cost about $29 trillion over 30 years. That's just about a trillion a year. Now, I know that sounds like a lot, but we have to remember that global GDP is over $80 trillion every year. And the estimated savings from implementing these solutions is $74 trillion, over double the costs. That's a net savings of $44 trillion. So drawdown is possible. We can do it if we want to. It's not going to cost that much, and the return on investment, that investment is huge. Here's the welcome surprise. When we implement these solutions, we shift the way we do business from a system that is inherently exploitative and extractive to a new normal that is by nature restorative and regenerative. We need to rethink our global goals to move beyond sustainability towards regeneration, and along the way, reverse global warming. Thank you.
So there's your case that reversing global warming is in fact possible and even attractive. And so the talk was titled 100 Solutions to Reversing Global Warming. They took the top 100, 80 of them already exist, 20 of them are beyond our technological reach right at the moment, although don't forget that 10 years ago the phone Tom is holding was the top end of our technological advancement. And 20 years ago, that was a thing on Star Trek. So even those 20, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but they cut out those 20, they could still fix it with the top 80 solutions. And when he took and sort of zeroed in on the highest impact solutions, they were land use and food, so how we use land, and especially how our use of land is tied to the food we eat, and the food choices we make. Refrigeration, the largest single solution, because the solution to one problem became another problem. That's a fairly common theme in human technological advancement. We're learning more about the problems that we cause with the problems that we solve. But there would be ways to refrigerate without using those HFCs. And then the number one, if you take these two, as he said, inextricably intertwined solutions, educating girls and family planning, which, hear what he said there, the net result of educating girls and providing universal access to family planning is to overall reduce the global population. We've seen that happen and continue to see that happen in the United States, that as women became more educated, they had fewer children on average. And we find today, the more educated a given woman happens to be, the fewer children she has on average relative to less educated women. That depends on the understanding the global population is a primary driver of the problem here. So he grouped these solutions into three types of solutions. So those were three sort of categories, but three sort of mechanisms. One is to replace the sources of energy that we use, to replace fossil fuels with renewables. So replace burning coal with wind power. The second is to reduce consumption of energy. That's actually a lot faster than replacing our sources of energy, right? So reducing consumption. How much energy do we use on a day-to-day basis, regardless of where it comes from? And then biosequestering. Which is to get that carbon back out of the air into life, into plants, into microorganisms, so to pull that back out of the air. And then at the very end, he gave us sort of the cost-benefit analysis. I haven't checked his numbers on the cost-benefit analysis, so there's my disclaimer. They said it would cost about $1 trillion a year over the next 30 years to implement these solutions. And over the next 30 years, the return on that investment would be about $74 trillion. So there's a net economic return on that investment. So there's your 100 solutions, three of which are super cool. What did you hear?
Well, I did check with Dr. Google about natural refrigerants.
Yes.
We have this sign in our office that says, not a doctor. It has like a Google colors on it.
Yes. So,
And interestingly enough, the one at the top of this list is carbon dioxide, which has to operate at very high pressures. So if you get a discussion with an engineer, they may have some discussion about that. Ammonia is used in industrial refrigeration and used to be used in home refrigeration, which I didn't know is highly toxic, so I guess that's why it's not in home refrigeration anymore. We know ammonia is bad. And the others are propane, isobutane, propylene, ethane, and ethylene, which are flammable. And then there was another list that had air and water. So hopefully we'll go with air and water.
Air and water would be great, right?
So yeah. What's being done? I mean, is the government or anybody doing anything about the refrigeration issue to make available?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to. I don't know if Dr. Google follows up with that. That's Professor Google. We're in science, not medicine now, right? Or really just Mr. Google, because it's all engineering, really. So I don't know. The way we got chlorofluorocarbons out of widespread use was through an international treaty. Because back in the 80s, when we had international treaties, we got together and said, hey, we're burning up the ozone layer with these CFCs. Everyone needs to get rid of them. And by and large, everyone did. Every so often, they'll find sort of a, somebody's cheating. By and large, CFCs have been replaced with these HFCs, which, solved one problem with another problem. If you can keep the HFCs inside the unit, I'm sure that's better, right? But I'm sure they also leak, right? That's a thing that if the CFCs had stayed inside the unit, that would have helped. So I don't know, but it probably would take some kind of large scale shift, either in the technology. See if you can get the technology to the point where these other solutions are just better, cheaper than the HFCs, then you can make a change without a big international deal. The shift away from CFCs happened with an international treaty because we didn't quite know what the next best solution was going to be, or it just wasn't cheaper than CFCs. So if you want to do something that sort of circumvents the short-term market forces, it helps to have a larger scale agreement. Here's what we're going to do. That depends a lot on how the market works, too, I'm thinking we want to... I would be interested in doing some work on economics next year. Economics for voters. What do you need to know in order to think about some of these great big decisions? Because I don't know how to do that cost benefit. But yeah, if we could do it with air, that'd be great.
Well, here's something about the conference where they're in Singapore, where they're promoting what they call CO2 water-to-water heat pump for the air conditioners in the hotel. It's like real hot there, so looks like the technology is already there.
Yeah. So that'd be great.
I can't help but say something.
Yeah.
What about the reality and the practicality of some of these things? How are we going to change some attitudes of some Christian denominations who really go by the mantra, be fruitful and multiply?
Oh, where's that?
I think there's a lot that there would be a lot to overcome with particularly the family planning, the family planning piece. I'd be interested to find out, you can do some research for me on this, to find out whether take a decline in birth rate as correlated with education. Which of those comes first? Do you change attitudes in order to bring down a birth rate? Or do you educate women and girls, and the decline in birth rate follows.
Yeah, I have an issue with that, too. I think we ought to educate the boys as well.
I think it would take some education of boys in order to be able, culture-wide, to educate women and girls.
Now, in the beginnings of our nation, it was sort of understandable that they would produce large families because they needed people to work the land. You know, and they expected that there would be some children who would die at birth, right, and so forth, you know, but like John Adams had 15 children, you know, and I think 11 of them survived and so forth, you know,
right,
that was to till the land. But in some cultures, they may need to have a large family in order to exist.
And remember that those cultures are our culture until 90 years ago, 100 years ago. The culture didn't change until 40 years ago, right?
Right.
Hold up, use however many hands you needed. How many siblings were in your house growing up?
Four.
Siblings?
Well, count yourself.
Oh, okay.
How many children were in your family? Five there, two in mine. Yeah, so we were a little ahead of the curve, I think, in terms of family size, right? Family size in developed, affluent Western, whatever that means. In affluent nations, family size is smaller than in less affluent nations. And part of my point is that that's a change that happened here, sort of along with some cultural changes, but women got to vote in 1920, they got to enter the workforce after World War II, kind of, then again in the 70s. Maybe eventually they'll get paid the same as men. So the shift around women's rights is still ongoing. Gender equality, to put that more broadly. So the shift around gender equality is still happening in the United States, and our birth rate is already down because women go to college now. Heck with that, women get through high school now, right? And so that's a shift that has happened here in our culture, rather than just thinking about if it's someone else's culture. I would bet that education is the driver rather than culture there.
50 years ago, when I was in seminary, we had a professor who, he and his wife made the decision not to have children because of the population.
Right.
You know, they were concerned about it at that particular time.
Right.
You know, so forth. I can't imagine that kind of conversation and that kind of willingness to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow.
Right.
You know, the other thing I wanted to say was that, you know, our kids, grandkids live in Kansas City. And every time we go down there, we see more land destroyed for parking lots and businesses and things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But when we come back and then drive through Des Moines, the same thing is going on here.
Right.
You know, there's new stuff going on, and farmland and everything else is being denuded and so forth. And these wonderful, beautiful, old trees are just trashed.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. That really bothers me. Is our attitudes need to change about all these kinds of things,
right?
And I don't know where to begin about that.
Yeah. Bob and I were talking about ZPG, zero population growth, and
was
very popular at the time we were planning our family.
Yeah.
And that was, we took that real seriously.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. So. So where do we start? And that's sort of the, I think that's going to end up being sort of the final question here. In the Covenant Corner email, there was a link, and we'll run that link again in this week's Covenant Corner. The most important thing you can do to fight climate change, talk about it. And this is another climate scientist, Catherine Hayhoe, speaking 2 months after this particular talk. There are TED Talk conferences going on all the time. It's great. So she says, the most important thing we need to do about climate change is to talk about it, because the conversation about climate change is broken, right? The way that we discuss with one another climate change is broken. And so Catherine Hayhoe's point is that when we talk about climate change on the level of is it happening or not, and did humans cause it or not, we don't advance the conversation. And the place that we need to start is with what are the values that we bring to this conversation? Who is it that we care about? What is it that we care about as we enter into this conversation? And you know, the facts are great for digging deeper. That's why I wanted to sort of bring us through some facts as a group here, because I think it is important for us to know, at least at the broad strokes, here's what is going on, and here's how we know what is going on. But really, that's for digging deeper once we're already convinced. So at least convinced that this matters, right? The facts by themselves, if we are confronted with facts that go against sort of how we've pictured ourselves, the facts themselves just tend to harden us into avoiding that conviction, right? Catherine Hambo says, most people already have the values that they would need to care about global warming. It's a matter of finding and connecting with people on the level of values, finding the values that we bring to it and the values that you bring to it, so that we can talk at that level. You know, is this the world we want for our grandchildren? Is this, is this a true testimony to who God is in the world? And you can only do that if you actually believe the thing you're saying. So you have to actually talk from your values. Don't like try to find somebody else's values and pretend you hold them, right? If I really don't care about the same thing that you happen to care about, A, that's probably not true, but B, we're not gonna have a very productive conversation there. So she says, talk about your values, talk about solutions, talk about what can be done, and talk about how we can benefit, what good this would do. Changing the way that we eat, right? Eating a more plant-based diet is actually really good for the health of our overall land and water system, right? It means that we don't have to spend as much money in Des Moines cleaning nitrates out of the water, because whether there's a good regulatory solution upstream or not, if I am buying less meat, then I'm paying someone to produce less meat, which changes what happens downstream. That matters to me. And I think it can matter to the person who has a little bit more margin to decide what to grow. There's other stuff with our agricultural system that there's a lot to go on here, economics for voters, that's sort of where I'm thinking. But that it makes a difference, right? So the point is to really get to the level of what matters. And what can we do? What can we do together about it? So you are hereby commissioned to not go tell people, I took this class and I know global warming is definitely happening and humans are definitely causing it, and you need to think that too, right? Because that's not going to get anywhere. But rather, boy, I took this, you know, 4 weeks of contemporary issues, and I'm really seeing how my values are expressed in what I buy, where I go, what I do, who I interact with, and how I interact with them. And I'm really wrestling with that. That would be a really great conversation. So that's where to go. Go in peace, come back in September. We'll talk about something maybe or maybe not completely different, but something in addition. So, thanks.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.